The Future of Teamwork is a Leader production. Subscribe today and never miss an episode.
The pressures that leaders are under today, the things that they have to navigate, the things they have to respond to, I am very confident in saying that a lot of their predecessors couldn't have handled it.
Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast. My name's Dane Gruneveld, and today I'm joined by Mel Doman. Mel has some cool work and titles to her name. So an organizational psychologist, an author, there's a couple of books there behind her, but the latest book, Cornered Office, we're going to be speaking a lot to today. And then she's also the founder of the Workplace Mental Health Method. So I'm fascinated by this conversation. We're already riffing really hard pre-show. So welcome and thanks for being here, Mel.
Thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to this.
How did you come to be doing this work? I mean, you're really pushing some boundaries out there from what I sense.
Your sense is correct. I tend to be the one who points out things quite early and being like, well, this is illogical or this is stupid or why are we doing this? And did you ever see the movie Moneyball?
Yes.
Yeah, I love that movie. And for someone who's not a sports buff, I love a lot of sports movies because of lessons around like mental health and leadership and whatever.
Yeah.
And the owner of the Boston Red Sox in that movie said, the first one through the wall always gets bloodied.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, God, I identify with that. So, and that's okay. So I used to do clinical psychology and I left clinical psych, gosh, in 2013, long time ago. Uh-huh. And the reason I did that is because all of my clients did not feel they could discuss mental health in the workplace or emotions really at all, or stress, and or they felt their workplaces were torturing them. So I was like, okay, let me see if I can make an impact at the source.
Yep.
And that was important to me because I felt like I was treating clients in a broken system and a broken narrative. I was like, this alone is not going to do it.
Yeah.
So that was a difficult decision, but an important one. And I transitioned into very traditional org psych. So emotional intelligence, intentional communication, constructive conflict. I still do that work. I love doing that work. As you and I talked about pre-recording, you know, teaching people in the adult playground that we call the office how to share their toys a bit better, not be dicks to each other, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But I found that when I mentioned mental health, people would like proverbially hiss at me.
Mm.
And I was like, well, that's weird because those are not dirty words. So fast forward, you know, I'm living in London with my husband and I was on a people and leadership development contract. And they're like, hey, you used to be a therapist. Could you do a mental health awareness campaign? I was like, you bet your butt I can. And it just exploded from there. I was like, okay, wow. the market is telling me that it's ready, that it's hungry, and that it needs to know where to go.
Yeah.
So that was back in 2018. And it has been a long, really rewarding journey, you know, teaching companies, leaders, and employees the skill set, emphasis on skill set, of how to talk about mental health communication and team dynamics in the workplace, because we don't need more people saying mental health matters. I'm like, yeah, no shit. How do people actually talk about it?
Yeah.
And understand the boundaries of that conversation in the workplace?
Yeah.
And how to actually make it work for themselves and others. That should be the goal, to build conversational literacy. And I haven't seemed to have lost anybody yet.
No, that's brilliant. The boundaries are interesting because, you know, we're talking pre-show that a lot of leaders will not want to talk about it. And sometimes I think that's driven by HR, you know, compliance. But it does bite if you don't talk about it.
So they're both true.
Yeah.
So that's actually one of the reasons that I partnered with an employment attorney. She is the best, Kelly. She's a partner at her firm, and we created this program teaching companies, in particular HR leaders and people managers who are both subject to compliance, about how to talk about mental health well within the boundaries of the law.
Yes.
Because it is nuts to me that that is not part of all leadership development standard training.
Yes.
When it should be. I mean, if you even take like the dispassionate, ardent capitalist lens, mm-hmm. if you want to, you know, CYA, why wouldn't you teach them that so they could understand what to say, what not to say, why that matters, how to have effective conversations? Because think about all the positive results that that can give, yes. as opposed to not. So that's why we launched that program, is we're like, well, saying you don't know is not an acceptable excuse, because the information is there. So I think the lack of understanding around compliance is a very real barrier, because lots of people screw that up. Mm-hmm. It escalates. It can go poorly from managers or HR doing it, or can go poorly from the employee side, because we're not going to sit here and pretend that out of the 8 billion people on the planet, that some people don't game, abuse, or manipulate the system.
Sure. Yeah.
But on top of that, and most importantly, mainly, people need to talk about it. They do, because wouldn't logic dictate that if you're struggling, you want to use resources, you want to get support,
yeah.
you want to take care of your needs, you want to communicate your needs to other people so you can be healthier, so you can function better, so you can perform better. What a novel freaking idea.
Yeah. It makes so much sense. And at the same time, there's another barrier that I'm feeling here. And everyone talks about psychological safety, but when you're afraid of your job, which is maybe higher now than ever with the whole AI kind of
oh God, hype don't cycle, get me started.
Then people are afraid of their jobs. They're typically putting their heads down and trying to look busy. They don't want to share any sign of weakness. And then managers on the flip side are trying to just get work done, and they don't want to unearth something that may cause a shift in the way that work's doing. So I'm kind of feeling like everyone's becoming hyper-individualized right now and not thinking about the dynamics of how the team is wellness and what the team's doing work.
Well, gosh, I blame the United States in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. Let me explain why.
Yeah.
So I'm second generation American, but I come from a collectivistic culture, collectivistic family background. And I think that there is such a push, I would say globally, for individualistic thinking and ways of doing things, and a complete underestimation of the importance of interdependence and social health and community.
Yes.
But also there are lots of things at play that are discouraging those things, but we're not going to, you know, spend all our time getting into the people that are profiting from that.
Yeah.
Because that's not the story for today.
Yeah.
Story for another time. But, you know, the thing is, there are plenty of workplaces that completely validate why those people do those things, because they have seen enough experiences occur where they're like, I am going to keep my mouth shut. Mm-hmm. This environment has told me what it is, will be, and will not be.
Yes.
And I'm not going to be a hero.
Yeah.
Because I'm not going to sit here and say that every company, every team, every industry is going to do the right thing. When in the history of ever
never
has all of humanity done that?
Yeah.
So the goal is to get enough companies, enough industries, enough people to recognize the importance of these principles so that the ones who don't become the minority. I think that's the realistic goal.
That's, yeah, I love that. I mean, we've been doing a lot of work with one of my teams on healthy teams. And our whole thing is it needs to become a movement. It's not a best practice. Mm. It's not dogmatic. But it needs to become
a way of doing things.
It's a way of doing things. And it's a belief system. It's a way of doing things.
Yeah.
And what I loved that you shared pre-show, Mel, is that we really need to be coming into this era of like humanized leadership. Everything I'm seeing suggests that, and you touched on it in that story too, we observe this is the way things get done. If you've got those underlying mythologies in a business, the only way to really get rid of them is to build new mythologies with humanized leaders.
Based on irrefutable logic.
Mm-hmm.
Based on irrefutable, I love that you use the term mythology, because in the second book, so there, I spend like the first chapter just being like, how did we get here? What's the history of this? What's the biological anthropologic history and all the like social science shit that I nerd out on? And then the second chapter is, well, why are we still here? Why do we still keep buying into these stories? And they are stories.
Mm-hmm.
And I even said something like, please allow my teeny tiny nihilist to come out for a minute and let me give you like a huge dose of existential dread that every company, every service, every good, every position, every title is all human created. Mm-hmm. All of it. All of the agreed upon norms of work, some driven by norms, some driven by laws, all human created.
Yes.
And you're going to sit here and tell me that we're going to treat leaders that we've created into these symbols as if they're a different species.
Yeah. I love that.
I'm like, am I alone in my principles? Like, what is this? And yes, when people are in positions of power and influence, of course, they're held to a different standard. Of course, we expect more of them. They're in a position of power and influence. In a lot of cases, they make more money. They have control over people, other people. Of course, they're held to a different rubric. But then, wouldn't logic dictate, if we want them to do these things to serve us, wouldn't we want to make sure they have the support to do so?
Mm-hmm.
Riddle me that, Batman. I feel like I'm screaming in the middle of a crowded room and no one hears me. And I'm just like, I know I'm being logical.
Yes.
But logic doesn't outdo narrative and big feelings.
Correct. Correct. And we've come through a really interesting period post-COVID, change in administration here in the US, the whole sort of attack on all things woke, which was a big umbrella term that I don't think anyone really spent much time defining.
I want to keep my blood pressure down today, friends.
Yeah.
But let's go where we need to go.
Yeah. Like, how do leaders tackle that when they're afraid their board's going to throw that word at them in the room, and they're already struggling with their performance because the market's not been where it was, or their teams are burned out. Like,
yeah,
where do you create the light?
Where do you create the light? You know what? It's kind of like a big black hole. Nothing escapes that event horizon.
Yeah,
I'm a big space nerd.
Nice.
I wrote a lot about that in chapter 4, and I talk about the section title, not joking, is When the World Burns, Leaders Burn Too.
Mm, I love that.
So let's take it down to basics. We are animals that can talk, correct?
Yes.
We are not that far removed, evolutionarily, in the grand timeline, from throwing excrement to settle arguments.
Uh-huh.
We are not that far removed from that. We are running on cave people hardware with modern software updates.
Mm-hmm.
So when you think about all the stuff going on that you just mentioned, I look at it as we are organisms in a shifting ecosystem that's extremely volatile and unstable. You know the term VUCA.
Yes.
Everybody and their mother uses that term, so I will. And people forget that we are talking, reactive animals just trying to figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
And the pressures that leaders are under today, the things that they have to navigate, the things they have to respond to, I am very confident in saying that a lot of their predecessors couldn't have handled it.
No chance.
No chance. And I'm not like goalposting trauma comparisons, just like objectively.
Yeah.
The number of things leaders are responsible for, the amount of things they have to worry about, the speed at which they have to do things, the number of skills they have to do well.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that those things are increasing and they have more people to answer to with less forgiveness and grace for not batting 1,000.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I understand why Gen Z's like, I don't want the gig. I'm good.
Yeah.
There's a term, conscious unbossing. They see what's happening to us elder millennials and Gen Xers and baby boomers, and they're like, oh my God, why would I want to do that? And I was like, I understand.
Yeah.
Because why would they step into this broken system of magical thinking? And I put that in chapter 2, which is like a throwback to my employee assistance counselor days when I used motivational interviewing. Why would they want to do that?
Yeah.
I get it. So they're like, okay, here are my choices, leadership or mental health. I choose the latter.
It's so true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And people love to criticize them. That's what generations love to do. They love to like finger point at each other and name call, which is exactly how you have great conversations.
gets you off on a really strong start.
Yeah, 100%. Great way to get people on side.
The reason, I love the way you framed that, Mel, but I also want to challenge the generational view, because so many people are talking generational, but I've got so many friends who are millennials or Gen X or boomers that have got plenty of talent, plenty of capability, and because they were privileged to have sold a business or inherited some money, or, you know, the kids moved out and they moved to a lower income, lower cost place to live, they're opting out of leadership roles that actually the world needs them in. So I don't think it's even generational.
I agree.
There's a lot of burnt out leaders who have got the talents that we need, and they're opting out.
I completely agree. And the reason I mentioned Gen Z, or in your case, Gen Z.
Yeah, that's right.
They're the ones who are the most vocal about it generally.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in particular, elder millennials and Gen Xers are doing it just as much, but we're not necessarily being as vocal about it.
Yeah.
And there are so many jokes about elder millennials in particular.
Interesting.
Where we used to be called the snowflakes, but people just didn't wait long enough to see how many things we would go through by the time we all got to 40.
Yeah.
And there are all these like jokes around, you know, on Instagram where they're like, you know, you were raised in a time in the 80s and 90s where talking about mental health wasn't really a thing.
Yeah.
You were raised to be these high overachievers, and then you burn yourself out, and now you have a therapist and 3 medications and like a cannabis subscription, and you're just like sleepwalking through life trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
And I think for us, like later in life, we're like, it's all been a lie. I don't want to do this because I am suffering.
Yeah.
We're just not as loud about it. And like some other elder millennials, I refuse to go on TikTok.
Yeah. Tell me more about
Instagram.
That.
I use Instagram like an adult.
Yeah. What's the difference?
You know, there is no difference. It's totally subjective.
Yeah.
I don't mess with Twitter. It will always be Twitter.
Yeah.
Not X. I don't mess with Twitter. TikTok just feels like the potential for addiction is far too high.
That makes sense.
And getting just lost in the spiral.
Yeah.
So there's a joke that goes around saying that millennials don't use TikTok because they use Instagram like an adult and watch them as reels 2 weeks later. And I was like, yeah. So no, it's I realize it's like this whole movement and people are just so embedded in it. And I'm like, I know myself well enough to know I'll get lost in the vortex.
Yeah.
So I don't mess with TikTok.
Just stay out. Luckily I've never signed in, but I'm not.
Neither have I.
To try.
I don't have an account. That's have an account. No.
So when you kind of scan back here, we've talked about, you know, leaders are not a different species, even though we've kind of culturally created this individual, like put them on a pedestal mentality. Yeah. You know, that when the world burns, leaders burn too. There's an argument right now with some of those dynamics we just touched on that the world is burning. There's a lot of challenge out there right now for different reasons, and we don't need to dive into it. But that ultimately means that teams are not showing up and delivering their best. And that they're not really clear on how to contribute to what next should look like. So when we think about the broken system and the humanized leader, where are some good examples of how you can bring in this mental health awareness and conversation at the leadership level to create lift or lightness amongst those people as they're, you know, getting on with their days and their jobs?
I honestly think that the best thing that they can do is acknowledge the dumpster fire. And I think that it doesn't mean that you can't have moments of hope. It doesn't mean you can't have moments of positivity. We need those to move forward. I have a friend who literally just released a book called Hope is the Strategy, because sometimes it is. And so, and I'm not saying and not to use that at all. Of course we should. But there's also some moments where acknowledging what's going on out there and in here is the key to rapport building for effective teamwork instead of just pretending.
Yes.
That we can shut it off, whether it's in a virtual team or in a physical place. It's just absurd. And so I think the way to connect as a team is by, you know, obviously being clear about having a constructive, cathartic conversation about that as opposed to trying to boil the ocean.
Yeah.
But even more importantly, what you're going to do to manage those big feelings. Because I think that the mental health conversations at work often get lost in people being like, we all have mental health and we should talk about that. And I go, great. What are people supposed to do with that?
Yeah.
What are they supposed to do with that? How is encouraging conversations enough when you should also be encouraging people to engage in the self-management part of emotional intelligence, not yes. just self-awareness? And leaders talking about that, about how they've also been impacted by what's going on and what they're doing about it to manage themselves, that shows sustainable, healthy leadership, where the conversation as a team, inclusive of leaders, is let's acknowledge the stressors and what we need to manage them.
Yes.
It feels painfully logical to me. But again, when we think about those boundaries, you know, not all conversations are meant for the workplace because sometimes people at work are not the people to help you.
Yes.
So if you need, for example, medical care because your anxiety has become so untenable that you need pharmacologic support, the workplace ain't the place for that conversation.
No.
If you are starting to have panic attacks, the workplace may not be the place for that conversation. I mean, yeah. It could be that I'm really struggling with anxiety. Like, do we have an EAP?
Sure.
Or do we have insurance? But like, don't go to your leader. Like, I'm having panic attacks. I'm freaking out. They're not a therapist.
No.
That's not their job. So I get very fiery about it because we are not trying to have an ironclad door or an open playing field. We're encouraging people to build a fence.
I like that. You decide
what you let through and what you're keeping out and what you let through.
Yep.
You know, if you're going to talk about it, whether you're a leader, whether you're an individual contributor, you got to think about, well, why am I talking about this at work?
Mm-hmm.
What do I want people to do with this information?
So intention.
What am I going to say that I'm going to do in connection to this conversation?
Yeah.
And is this workplace actually psychologically safe to have this conversation?
Yeah.
Or am I concerned too based on previous baggage?
So interesting. It's really interesting that intentionality and particularly I love the way that you bring it into doing, acting. We were doing
yes.
some work on the myths of performance management and there are plenty.
Ooh, that sounds spicy.
It was spicy. And the one that I really liked was myth number 5. It was some work that we were doing with Dr. Andre Martin. And his myth number 5 that he shared with us was leaders should ask for feedback. And actually the myth bust was that leaders shouldn't ask for feedback. Leaders should share how they're working on the feedback they've received. And I found that so much more powerful.
Hell yes.
Yeah.
Love that so much. And that's also a really great example of role modeling. Like, I can't tell you when I was an EAP counselor how few leaders I spoke to because they were so afraid to use the service. Like, no, I encourage team members to use it. I'm like, I'm sorry, why are you an exception? I'm very confused. And one of the best ways, like, I was really struggling with X. And I called the EAP at 11 o'clock at night and I got to talk to someone for half an hour.
Yes.
It was awesome.
Yep. Lifts awareness, ability.
Yes. And they used the tool.
Yeah.
And they said how it helped them. And then it encourages other people to use it and it humanizes them in the process and shows they don't have limitless capacity.
But you still had a boundary that they didn't have to really go into the depths of the moment
of
this. Yeah, I love that.
Exactly.
That's cool.
Exactly. So it's it doesn't have to be like this weird thing, you know, and it also doesn't need to be sharing a 35-year mental health history. That's not appropriate.
Correct.
No.
No.
So it's Or you, even someone being like, yeah, I really struggle with paralysis by analysis, so I'm working on that with my therapist.
Yeah.
Code for I have impressive levels of generalized anxiety disorder.
Yes.
So there's always a way, there you know?
Yeah, there is a way. Taking away that psychological safety piece, let's talk specifically to leaders. Mm-hmm. So a leader, let's take someone like me who might be in a CEO role. My board doesn't sit and watch how I'm operating every day with my team. So yeah, I can always get fired by my board, but I'm not too worried about, you know, what I say to someone in the organization having that impact, which is where I've often found psychological safety can bear its teeth. And yet I probably will share a concern that there are certain things I'm probably resistant to go out and have conversations with my team members about, because
could you give an example?
So here's a good example. We're just going to go live with it here. I sold one of our businesses last May. We had our fourth child in April, and I agreed I'd take 3 months off and do the parental leave thing, which was awesome. And after doing the 3 months of parental leave, I still didn't come back into a full-time capacity because I was enjoying it. And I think I was starting to go through more of a burnout cycle. We'd sold the business. We'd got over the objective. Once I took time off and I wasn't in that constant, like, adrenaline, cortisol, you know, cocktail.
I am deeply familiar with it.
It came at me, right? So from really the back end of the summer into Christmas, I got quite ill and a lot of things didn't work my way. And I was happy to share that I wasn't well and I wouldn't be at meetings. But I never really stopped and said, guys, I think this is burnout. Because here's why I was resistant to not sharing that with my team, who will get to hear it now. It's like revelations. At the time, I was afraid that they would lose hope, lose confidence. You know, we're going through a tough time in the market. It's not I'm afraid that my boss is going to fire me. I'm afraid that my team's going to struggle. And I didn't want to put that burden on my team. So walk me through this one real time.
Well, tell me, why? I'm going to ask you a question and then I'm going to tell you a story. Why do you think that your mind assumed that in your position, telling your team that you felt burnt out would be a burden to them? Where did you learn to think that?
So I'm going to have a bit of a hack here because I've actually been doing that work in therapy and with a coach.
Good man.
So that is actually more of a childhood belief system of mine that I needed to be looking out for and protecting others, you know, somewhat parentified as a kid. And therefore...
Were you the parentified child?
Yeah, 100%. You too. So we feel this. So I think my natural predisposition is I want to take people's concerns away from them, not create... concerns for them. And what that means is that I do them a disservice, is what I'm learning, because I don't allow them to be the adults that they are and handle what is right there.
Ding, 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 ding.
Yeah.
Chapter 7 of the book talks about something called the leadership mental health archetypes.
There you go.
And there is something called the mother hen or the father goose.
Cool.
So I encourage you to take a look.
Okay, so tell me about the father goose behaviors. Maybe my example is a good example, but or the mother hen. How do those leaders start shifting if they haven't yet started to do some of the inner work? And
it's hard to.
It is.
It's really hard to, and it's one of the reasons that you as a leader teach people they don't need to support you.
Interesting.
So history teaches leaders that they shouldn't need support.
Yeah.
And leaders continue that by teaching people they don't need support. But even though they want it and they need it, history has taught them you will break the vision of what you are. People will lose faith in you. They will not see you as credible. They will see you as weak. You won't be able to do the job.
Yep.
Whereas I go, a big fuck you to all of that.
Love it.
and
on
say, can
big
we
poster
stop?
Board.
Oh, do you want to see my jar of fucks that my friend bought me?
That's unreal.
I love it so much. I go, can we please stop pretending that success and struggle don't exist in the same body?
Brilliant. Yeah.
Please?
Yeah.
So now, I wasn't planning on doing a reading, but let's take a look at Father Goose. Let me see. Chapter 7. Oh, boy. This is the first time I've done a live reading on a podcast.
Awesome.
This is great.
I feel privileged.
So, there are 7 archetypes that I came up with.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I break it down is it's hard to change your behaviors around mental health and leadership if you don't know what you do, why, and the function that they serve.
Yes.
So I talk about, you know, what the archetype means, how it can show up at work, the positives and the negatives.
Mm-hmm.
So I will read this for you if you'd like. It's
Please.
Just like a few paragraphs.
Yeah.
The mother hen or the father goose. What this may mean. You may believe that the most important use of your energy is to care for and look out for others' well-being. You are likely to often focus on genuinely supporting others' mental health and helping them manage their stress. You may see yourself as the emotional savior and protector of others because you believe they need you and may not be able to do it without you.
Yeah.
Do you feel attacked? Do you feel attacked yet?
I'm feeling it. Yeah.
You may even subscribe to servant leadership or believe that part of being a leader is serving as a shield for those you lead.
Uh-huh.
How this can show up at work. You might be viewed as the, quote, parental type within your team division or organization. As a parent-like protector, you're likely the go-to person for emotional support or shielding for others at work. You ensure that those you lead don't face emotional discomfort if you can help them avoid it.
Mm-hmm.
And you typically don't check in on yourself or ask others for support. When people check in on you, you may respond politely with something like, oh, I'm fine, let's talk about what you need.
Yeah.
You tend to be the caring fixer type, trying to lift the burden off of others because if you can, you feel like you've done your part for the day.
Interesting.
The positives. You are likely very compassionate and empathetic, making great efforts to ensure those you lead feel psychologically safe with you. You ensure that everybody who works for you knows you. They can always approach you with anything happening in their lives. You determine how to support them best or help them get the necessary resources. You're recognized as one of the, quote, good ones, someone who goes above and beyond when it comes to acknowledging mental health, encouraging self-care, and using emotional intelligence. The negatives. You live an inch away from burnout, but convince yourself that's what it is for being in the service of others looks like. You might teach those you lead that only their mental health matters, even if it means they keep standing on your shoulders while you sink.
Yeah.
You may show them that you are and will only be their supporter and that you never need support in return.
Mm-hmm.
You may experience compassion fatigue and struggle to acknowledge it. You might unintentionally create an emotional dependency on you from others at work, but you may also enjoy being needed that way. You may deprioritize your needs because your primary driver is to be needed by others.
Yeah. It's so fascinating. I mean, you nailed it in many ways. And I'll challenge certain parts of it, not challenging the logic or the theory, but mm-hmm. that I think at different times in one's career, certainly my experience was it was very helpful early and towards the latter end, much less helpful.
Oh, and you could also be... You can vacillate between archetypes.
Interesting.
Yes. So there can be, you can resemble several.
Yes.
Or you can take aspects of several to make your own.
Very
which is
cool.
What I encourage in the chapter, saying you may see yourself in several of these.
Where does it show up?
And that's fine. That's fine.
Yeah.
Compile it all and you get to decide what that archetype is.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
I just give 7 as like a guide.
Yeah, it gives you a rough canvas or broad
yeah.
canvas. That's really interesting. And the piece of feedback that I got off a wonderful colleague, Jenny McCambridge, when we sold the business last year, she was like, you always make so much time for us and tell us this, but we know you're not living by the same values for yourself. And I was just like, gut punch. And thank you.
Yeah. It does exist where people say stuff like that. It's just not the norm.
Mm. It was a very caring, courageous moment for her to share that with me. And it's actually helped me a lot in decisions that I've made and where we continue to go, which is super cool.
Absolutely. And the thing is that the narrative shift we're going for is talking about my emotional health as a leader is what it takes for sustainable leadership.
I love that. Yeah.
And that should be a part of leadership development. That should be a part of effective teamwork. You know, it's, and again, we're not trying to create a freaking kumbaya circle.
No.
It's just, you know, is compartmentalizing emotion sometimes a necessity? Of course it is. I'm not stupid.
Yeah.
But is that something we should always be doing? Absolutely not. When does that ever go well?
Yeah. You gotta balance
so,
it.
Just like the simple stuff, like I'm feeling really frustrated and helpless because I keep saying the same feedback over and over again, and it feels like you're not hearing me.
Yeah.
I don't want to assume why. Can we talk about this? But that, do you know how many people's like buttholes clench up if they hear something like that?
Yeah.
Because that takes a lot of courage and openness to getting your stuff lit up.
Sure. Yes.
But that's okay.
It is okay.
Hard things are important.
And I think that's why I take a lot of hope out of the moment that we're living through societally and that personally I'm getting the privilege to move through, which is that if we do light it up, if we do show people that it's okay to talk about what we're working on, you know, what we want to do more of, less of, and we attach it to the work, it's not isolated from the work. Then there's ways for us to actually create way more connective tissue in our teams.
Yes. And taking it a step further, not even that it's okay, that it's critical, that it's healthy, that it's beneficial, that there's value.
Yeah.
Because creating permission is one thing. Creating value is another.
Yeah.
There's value in doing that. And of course, you got to attach it to the context of work, the context of teamwork. You know, you can't come in there with whatever you're struggling with that may be outside of work that is not for those people to carry.
Yes.
But you can let them know what's going on in case it changes how you show up for them at work.
Yeah. Yeah. And how they then start to show up for others. Because there will be other father gooses and mother hens in my team.
Correct.
And other archetypes. I love that.
But the nuanced approach takes a lot of energy, so I get why it's a skill that needs to be built over time.
And I particularly love pre-show you were not only sharing that it's a skill to be talking about mental health in the right way in business, is in the context of what we're here to serve as a purpose as a business, but you mentioned that the use of that skill can be best placed, you said, deploying emotional intelligence through constructive conflict. So I want to hit that.
My favorite.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. I love a good fight. And what I say good fight because I mean a good fight, a constructive argument. And that is so hard because we are wired to fight, to self-protect, to self-defend, and to win.
Yeah.
That is how we're wired.
Yeah.
That's just our nervous system and how we're built. So make no mistake, constructive conflict is very unnatural and it is a learned skill, but a really important one because when you can safely have productive debate, so many good things come from that. I mean, I'm not the first person to say that. Like Patrick Lencioni in his 5 Dysfunctions of a Team talks about conflict. You can't have constructive conflict without trust and psychological safety. And, you know, constructive conflict just so easily makes people feel like they're being attacked or their capabilities are being questioned or other things that existed and do exist outside of the company.
Yeah.
But discomfort around that is not a valid reason for avoidance. So I also, in connection to using emotional intelligence through constructive conflict, talk to people about building discomfort tolerance.
Oh, I love
that. Not resilience.
Yeah.
Discomfort tolerance. I literally talk about this constantly with my clients. I did a Disrupt HR talk, which is basically like TEDx for HR. And I talk about why discomfort tolerance is a critical workplace skill.
Yes.
Because resilience, as you all know, which everybody and their mother talks about, is the ability to healthfully bounce back from adversity. Mm. But what I say is, well, if you can't sit in discomfort, how can you bounce back from what you won't face?
Ooh, I love. So if you can't sit in discomfort, how can you bounce back from what you won't face?
Correct.
That's potent. Because I've lived through that, and I'm sure most leaders have lived through that, like, avoidance of the moment. So it's not really resilient. Yeah. You just swept it under the carpet. Yeah.
Correct. And so how can you engage in constructive conflict if you can't sit in discomfort without taking it out on yourself and your conversational opponent?
Yeah.
When it should be collaborator.
Yeah.
That most people don't do that, because who sits and teaches? I mean, they do more now with like social emotional learning with the younger generations, but most people are not encouraged to develop those skills. Like, we learn about it out of desperation later in life, and sometimes never even then.
Yeah.
So I think that constructive conflict cannot be done.
Yeah.
Without all aspects of emotional intelligence and building discomfort tolerance. Because if you think about the threat reward model,
yeah,
having discomfort tolerance means facing the threat head on instead of using avoidance to go towards a perception of reward.
I love
which
that.
Is lack of a painful stimulus.
Yes. For me,
I talk about this all the time.
Oh, I'm super excited to dive into the book and have more conversation on this. I wish we had more time today, but
we'll just have to do another episode.
I'm all in for that. Discomfort tolerance excites me for a couple of reasons, because, you know, there's a lot of literature out there that says that when you're in that discomfort, that's the edge of growth as an individual. But for companies right now that are trying to rethink, and teams within large companies rethink, what is their reason for being? What's their purpose? How are they going to serve customers, vendors, whoever else? Like, if you're not truly taking that front-on, head-on approach to discomfort, you're going to miss the opportunity. So I think the companies that win, the teams that win, will probably not only be healthier, have more awareness of mental health and wellness, but they'll also be more innovative. And that's super exciting.
Oh, yeah. And I would even, if we're zooming out even further, the teams and companies that adapt and survive.
Mm-hmm.
Because right now it's and for me, like, yes, winning in the market, like, I get that. That makes sense to me.
Yeah.
And oh, my God, if we look around us, the rules of the game have changed. Mm-hmm. So at this rate, it's not even just about winning in the market. It's just being able to adapt and survive, because oh my God, this, we have gone so far off the sacred timeline.
I don't
know if you're a Marvel fan.
I love Marvel.
I was like, maybe he'll get my sacred timeline joke. I'm so excited for Doomsday come in like 8 months, and I'm just, my impatience as a neurodivergent person is like just torturing me. But you know, I will sit in that discomfort.
Yeah.
And I will survive.
You'll get
wait
there.
Until December.
That's neat. I also like that you're bringing me back full circle to the broken system. You know, the rules have changed, but the best lead is going back to the mythology, building new mythologies. We can build new systems with this way of thinking. Mm-hmm. You know, starting with teams, folding over into our customer organizations, our communities, our families. That's what really lights me up.
It does for me as well. And then it makes me also observe, I think I posted about this on LinkedIn like a week ago, about people's addiction to dysfunction because of familiarity.
Is it just familiarity, or is it because the dysfunction serves them? If I know how to win in the dysfunctional state.
I would say yes and.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's so many reasons people do that. Fear of the unknown, fear of consequences.
Yeah.
Familiarity. The dysfunction serves me. There are lots of reasons that people don't fix what's broken.
Yeah. Well, that's super cool. What I love about this conversation today, Mel, is that, and we've just kind of riffed and gone in different places.
I know. I can't wait to listen to this.
Me too. but we've kind. I think what I really appreciate you doing is you've kind of role modeled how we can have a conversation about it without being bleeding hearts that need to go and solve all of these things for all of these people. It's
because that shit doesn't work.
Yeah. But it's just really structured, good conversations about.
Thanks.
I liked your fence analogy. And I liked attaching it to the right types of work in an organization. And I think getting that balance, starting with the right sound bites, the right moments that you share with team members, creates what feels like very healthy scaffolding as we go forward.
That's what we're going for, you know, both in my first book and my second one. Because the first one is basically, hey, you know, this topic that a lot of us misunderstand is very deeply personal. Well, here's what it actually means. Mm. And then here's how to talk about it effectively in the workplace. And then the second book is about how leaders are expected to facilitate that conversation and are precluded from it in a lot of ways. So the way I approach it is mental health is a very personal, ambiguous, amorphous, other A words sort of topic.
Yeah.
So why not give people a framework or like a balance bar they can hold on to as they go into this a conversation like that, that is so misunderstood, so stigmatized, so complicated sometimes.
Yeah.
And just give them the things to aim for so it doesn't feel like they're just throwing words into a conversational abyss that feels very high risk.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So that's the approach I take. And I actually think that me being neurodivergent probably influences how I look at that. But I'm like actually neurodivergent, not TikTok diagnosed neurodivergent. You have to say that these days.
Yeah, you do.
I was diagnosed as a kid. And I think that I'm only just realizing that now, I think, like on this podcast, that I think being neurodivergent is what makes me look at these conversations this way.
Yeah. Which I love.
I'm like, yeah.
I mean, in Australia, neurodivergence, particularly autism, has been misclassified for so long as a disability. That's how you get funding. And yet there are certain types of neurodivergence that may need to be treated that way. But actually, I think there's a lot of neurodivergence, which is surprisingly, and I don't want to get too deep into it evolution-wise, but for me, it's surprisingly necessary for dealing with the world we have to process today.
Oh my God, yes. And I have a section on neurodivergence in leadership in chapter 3.
Awesome.
And it's not a deficit. It is just a difference.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's some types of neurodivergence and other kinds of, like, you know, true developmental disabilities.
Yes.
But in other cases, like certain forms of ADHD, I have ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, as I've gotten older, because I have a family member who was diagnosed as autistic later in life, and it helped me take a long, hard look at myself. And my therapist taught me, and when I was in clinical work, like you either specialized in developmental disabilities or you didn't, and
right.
I didn't. And she explained to me that autism, ADHD, and OCD all sit on a Venn diagram with each other. And I was like, oh my God, that makes sense.
Explains a lot.
So, And so, you know, it's really just a brain type and how we respond to stimuli in our environment, how we process information.
Mm.
And people with ADHD and autism, or I think actually in my case, I think I have ADHD.
Yes.
But I was diagnosed with ADHD as a child, but now at almost 41, I'm like, oh, I don't know. But my ability to see pattern recognition, to predict things that are going to come down the pipeline, I am highly, 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 highly attuned to people's emotional states.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is something that my neurodivergence equips me to do.
Yeah.
And so I'm also realizing in this very discovery-laden conversation that I think being neurodivergent is what makes me view mental health conversations this way.
Which is such a cool thing to be able to share and spread.
Yeah. Thanks for you're the therapist today. Thanks for bringing it out of me, man.
No, it's been super fun. We are going to do a second podcast and we're going to talk about a lot more.
Yeah.
But for any of our listeners that want to find the books or your work with the Workplace Mental Health Method, how do they seek out finding you?
Well, if you would like me to come into your organization and help people have adult conversations about mental health, communication, and team dynamics in the workplace, melissadoman.com is the best way to find me. I do fireside interviews, interactive workshops, team offsites, strategic consulting, all those fun corporate words. You can also find me on LinkedIn, Instagram. It's at the Wandering Mel because I love to travel. And both of my books, Cornered Office, Why We Need to Talk About Leadership Mental Health. And Yes, You Can Talk About Mental Health at Work, Here's Why and How to Do It Really Well, are available across all major retailers online and in store.
Awesome. Well, Mel, it's been a blast. Thank you. It's been
thank you.
Enjoyable, fun, learning moments all in one. So I look forward to getting together again soon.
Same here. Me too.
Just a quick note before we go. The views and opinions shared in this episode are those of our guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the host, Dane Gruneveld, the Leader Group, our patron Huddle 3, or our partners and affiliates. Any scenarios discussed are for the purpose of fueling creative thinking and conversation and should be viewed only in this context. Dane, Leader, our sponsors, partners, and affiliates do not endorse any guest or any organization they may be associated with. It's important to remember that every workplace is as individual as the people within it. Our recommendation is to always seek solutions that are specifically designed to help serve your team's unique needs. And to this point, please know we're here, ready to help you find the best way forward, no matter where your starting point is. You can connect with Dane or myself, Alicia McCraw, on LinkedIn or via the links contained in the show notes. Thanks again for tuning in. And hey, if you think someone in your network would benefit from this episode, feel free to share it or give us a 5-star rating. Those 5 little stars really help us reach more curious people like you. We'll catch you next time on the Future of Teamwork.